Welcome to Startup Cornell, a podcast exploring the bold entrepreneurial ideas coming from our students, faculty, staff, and alumni. I am Kathy Hovis, your host, and today we're talking with Tim Berry. He's the chair and CEO of VillageMD, and he's also this year's Cornell Entrepreneur of the Year, so we are really happy to have him here. Tim founded VillageMD in 2013 with the idea that he could use technology, populations insights, and a network of expert healthcare professionals to provide high quality care, better patient outcomes, and a reduction in total costs. We will be honoring Tim on campus on April 11th and 12th during our celebration event, and he's also going to speak November 15th at our Eclectic Convergence Conference, which is at Cornell Tech in New York City. So if you'd like to hear him in person, make plans to come to one of those. To find out more about entrepreneurship at Cornell and see the show notes from this episode, visit eshep.cornell.edu. And remember to rate and review our podcast by scrolling to the bottom of this episode. We want to help more young entrepreneurs find the podcast and be inspired to follow their dreams. So welcome to Tim. I'm so glad you're here today.
Thanks so much, Kathy. Thrilled to be here.
So I know most people have probably heard of VillageMD, but I wonder if you could just give us a little bit of a pitch about what VillageMD is all about and what made you want to start this business.
Yeah, VillageMD is all about delivering the best healthcare we possibly can in the country and making sure that those people who frankly are today not being taken care of comprehensively in the healthcare system have access to proactive care, have access to primary care, specialty care, urgent care in a way that's thinking about the whole of the person and is focused in a model that is really trying to help people manage their conditions 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as opposed to so much of the healthcare delivery system, which is only available to you when you're sick. So to answer your question about why we started Village, when you look at the U.S. healthcare system, you realize that we spend $4.5 trillion per year on healthcare. We spend 2.5 times more on healthcare in the U.S. than any other industrialized nation. Yet the quality of care outcomes that we have in this country are a little bit better than third world nations. And so we said, how do we change that? How do we make sure that if we're paying for the most for a healthcare system, how do we make sure that people get the best out of the healthcare system? And what's interesting, Kathy, is that when you look at the $4.5 trillion we spend, over 80% of that is tied to patients who have chronic disease, which is less than 1 in 5 Americans. And so, you know, the famous 80-20 rule, the Pareto rule, we applied those same principles to really look and figure out that there's a small number of disease states that are things like diabetes, congestive heart failure, chronic kidney disease, COPD, these types of diseases that a small number of patients have. And we said, what would it look like for those people to have a model of care that ensured that they were being taken care of in the same way that they're living with their disease, which is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? And so we said, what we would do is we'd be much more proactive in helping these patients manage their disease. We'd be making sure that we're available to patients 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We'd make sure that if they have complications tied to a surgery, or if they are unclear about what their primary care and their cardiologists are telling them in regard to their care plan, that we create clarity for them and that they know that we're with them every step of the way along their healthcare journey.
Wow, that's awesome. So why do you think that no one has addressed this issue so far? Or why was it such a challenge and something that, you know, it took your company to actually do?
Yeah. So I have to tell you that so much of the way that the healthcare system acts is really tied to the way that we reimburse providers in the healthcare system. And so we have what's called a fee-for-service healthcare system. And so basically, if you're a provider, you get paid every time you provide a service. And so for organizations to do better financially, for their business to do better, they are actually incentivized to provide more services. And so from that standpoint, it's this perverse nature where people are only reimbursed for the very specific thing that they do, and they're not reimbursed for the outcome that they deliver. And so when you have this system that's been set up this way, frankly, for decades, it just works in that way, right? So everything from the way that insurance companies contract with providers, to the way the federal government contracts with providers, to the way that state governments contract with providers, to the whole machinery that's underlying the infrastructure of the healthcare system is set up to support a fee-for-service healthcare system. Now, if you had organizations that were just doing the right thing for their patients, they'd be getting paid a lot less. And part of the irony is that of the healthcare system is that you have so many nonprofit providers that today are living in this fee-for-service system, and they're continuing to proliferate the fee-for-service system instead of really doing the right thing for our patients. And so for us, like myself and my two other co-founders, we said enough's enough. Like people deserve a better system. And we said, if we change the way that we're paid, and we're paid based upon the outcomes that we deliver for our patients, then at that point in time, we're aligned with the patient, because no one wakes up on January 1st and says, my New Year's resolution is to be hospitalized. And so people actually want to live their best life, right? They want to live this happy, healthy life and use the healthcare system as little as they need to, right? That's what we all want as individuals. And so we said, how do we create a system like that? And how do we make sure then that we go to the insurance companies? How do we go to the government? And how do we create an economic model that rewards us for doing that? And so that's what we had to go and change that economic model. And that took years to try to get in place where we had the right level of alignment between our business model and the outcomes that we knew we could generate with the way that we get paid. So today we generate margin when we have happier patients who don't need to use the healthcare system as much.
Wow. Wow. So it's like a sea change in the whole way that things work.
It is. It's really interesting because you can imagine, think about it, a $4.5 trillion industry. It's all going, it's a freight train going in one direction. And here we are, started off as this little fish swimming against the stream. And now thankfully, there's lots of other organizations who, like us, do the same thing, that realize that there's a better way, that people deserve better healthcare, that people should get the best outcomes they can. And so there's more and more organizations who are starting to do the kind of work that we do.
And do you have any hope, like in the, you know, whenever this might be, that the entire system would kind of switch into this new way of operating the same way that you are? Or is it just like, that's a dream?
Depends on the day of the week, right? So there's certain days that I'm convinced that we and others are going to completely transform the system. And then there's days where it's like, oh my God, what are we doing, right? But that's the journey of every entrepreneur. I will say this, that there are some economic realities that do exist on the macro level, right? Like the Medicare Trust Fund is going to go bankrupt, right? The cost of health insurance for a family of four a generation ago used to be the equivalent of a monthly car payment. It's now actually, for most families, the cost for health insurance is more than their mortgage. So we're getting to a point where some parts of this are just so economically unsustainable that changes have to be made. And if I could wave a magic wand, I'd make every healthcare provider have to deliver care and be transparent about their outcomes in the exact same way that we are. Do I think it can happen? Yes. Do I think I'll be alive when it comes to fruition? No. I think it's going to still be, you know, decades and decades away. But I will say I'm encouraged by the doctors themselves, the healthcare providers, because they go into the practice of medicine because they have a big heart. At the end of the day, every doctor goes into medicine because they want to make an impact on people's lives. And unfortunately, we put them onto this fee-for-service treadmill and we ask them to run and run really fast. And I think that as organizations like ours get more scale, there's going to be more and more doctors who vote with their feet. And they say, you know what? I want to practice medicine in a way that I know my patients get the best outcome. And I think there will be a tipping point that happens, but it's got to be a lot more doctors who are involved in the process.
Right, for sure. So I know that you as CEO are probably not in the trenches every day dealing with patients, but I wondered if you have any anecdotes or any stories of patients that you've heard of from the doctors that you work with who had potentially worked in a, you know, regular healthcare system and then came to work with you guys and have told stories of how different it is or how it impacted them. Some anecdotes of how that's made a difference for people.
Yeah, well, I will tell you, it happens every day. And there, the beauty is I get, you know, letters and emails and I get phone calls every day, not just when we screw something up, which every company does from time to time, but from incredible stories where people talked about that they sort of lost all hope, and which has got to be the worst feeling in the world to lose all hope. And they talked about, you know, trying to find a new provider, and they came to Village. And by the way that they were greeted in our clinic, to the way that the provider spent extra time with them, to the fact that there was a social worker that followed up with the patient while in the clinic and then followed up the next day and the next several days. And then to learn that there's a pharmacist who came to the home to help that patient who was on 27 different medications, kind of whittle down the medications to the appropriate 18 that they should have been on, which still feels like a ton, to that patient working with one of our dietitians so that the point where they eventually lost 20, 30 pounds and they started being more active, and we connected them into some social communities that we create amongst our patient base or even amongst the communities where they live, where suddenly there's other people that care for them, right? And that's what I think is the coolest part about our healthcare system, and why I sort of never lose faith in humanity by having the job that I do, because I get to see the impact that when we all just focus on caring for each other and we focus on bringing love to a situation as opposed to bringing hate or anger or anything else, people do rise to the occasion. And there's a recent example of a patient who just unfortunately lost their spouse, and they talked about the fact that the model of care they believe kept their spouse alive for years longer than what they quote unquote should have. Mm-hmm. And it's all because they had hope and they had care and they had support and they had people that were there to help them. And so I think what makes our company really special is that our patients feel that. Like they really see the patient and then see them for who they are and want to work to help that patient achieve their outcomes. And that's what's special, right? And we all deserve it, right? It's hard to do it for every single patient. But as I said before, in our healthcare system, it's less than 1 in 5 Americans who are dealing with these extra complications that we really try to make sure we take care of them as well as we can.
So talk a bit about the company and what your goals are. You're in a number of states already. Are you looking to expand the number of states? Are you looking to build new clinics or be in more locations like Walgreens? Or what are some of the things that are you pretty happy with the way things are right now? You know, what are some of the goals you have?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, Kathy, because and there's so many entrepreneurs who can appreciate this, is that when you set out to create your company, you have a vision for what it can be. And depending on the day of the week, I think we're either nowhere near where we should be or we're well beyond where we should be. And the thing I would say is that for how we have grown as an organization over the last 11 years, we've had just hyper growth. We got to a point where in 2022, we were opening up a new clinic every 73 hours. And when you think about the dedication of people to a goal, and you think about the amount of hours that they worked and all that's required to open up a clinic, it's really quite remarkable. You know, I compare that to organizations that have grown, like retail organizations that have grown that fast, like a Chipotle grill. I'd argue it's a lot harder to hire and train staff and physicians than it is to sort of open up a restaurant. Both are hard, right? But there's a different level of what has to happen in a clinic. And for us, we grew, frankly, too fast. We got to a point where we were out kicking our ability to execute on the day in, day out of the business. And so over the last kind of year and a half, we've had to really rationalize all the growth that we've had and really make sure that we're never losing sight of the reason we exist in the first place, which is to make sure we're delivering excellent care to patients. And frankly, when some of the components of your infrastructure aren't necessarily where you want them to be, then you have to just acknowledge that. And it means you've got to slow down a little bit and maybe retrench a little bit in order to have the chance to really grow again. And that's been a really incredible lesson for me as an entrepreneur, a painful lesson. And so to answer your question strategically, what I tell you is I love every place where we are. And I think that in each one of the markets where we operate today, and whether that's in New Hampshire or that's in New Jersey or Connecticut or Texas, Atlanta, Phoenix, you name it, like wherever we are, we have so much opportunity to still grow, and we should be capturing those opportunities as they exist and then patiently thinking about how we expand into more markets down the road. But, you know, I'd say right now we're very happy with where we're at. We want to keep ensuring that we're delivering great care, we're growing in the markets where we are, and then think about some more growth beyond that.
That's awesome. So let's switch a little bit and talk about your time at Cornell, because I know that we are excited that you're our Entrepreneur of the Year, and I think you were excited to hear that news too. So maybe tell me, like, how did you choose Cornell? What did you major in? What were some of the memories you have of your time at Cornell that you think have impacted you as you move forward?
Yeah, Cornell is such a special place to me. When I grew up in a small town in Northeast Wisconsin, and it's a funny story. I was a junior in high school, and I was sitting in my grandfather's living room, and it was my grandfather, my dad, and me, and we were watching TV, and the Harvard-Yale football game was on, and my dad said, you know, if you keep working at football, you might be able to play in this game someday. And it's so funny because I look back on it and I was always a fairly motivated kid, did well academically, enjoyed sports, but I never really thought about like, where would I go to college, right? Like I knew I was going to go to college, but I never really spent a lot of time thinking about it. It was after that, that I went back to school after the Thanksgiving weekend. And I met with my football coach and I said, so do you think I could play college football in the Ivy League? And he said, yeah, I do. And it's funny because I'm not sure he ever had someone go to play in the Ivy League. So I don't know why he thought yes, but he was, you know, he was a great example of how someone who had confidence in his people. And so he filled out a card for all these different programs. And so I started hearing from coaches, and the university that intrigued me the most was Cornell. And I liked the coaches that I was talking to. And then I visited the school. And once I visited the school, I just fell in love with it. It was just, it felt like the right place for me to be. And so I'm very grateful that I was admitted to the school. And my time on the Hill was just unbelievable. I tell people all the time, I joke that I'm maybe one of the worst students in the history of Cornell. I was not as motivated academically as I should have been. And my son, who's a freshman there now, I'm so proud of his commitment to academics. But I tell people all the time that when I went there, my mind was expanded at just by a whole different dimension. The people I met, the things that you could explore. So many, even though I wasn't the best student, it was just so fascinated to think about learning all these things at this university and experiencing all these experiences that, you know, it was just a complete explosion in my mind of like what's out there and what's possible in the world. And so my time was amazing. I loved the people I met. I'm still very close with the people that I was in school with. I was part of a fraternity. We still get together 30 plus years later. And the friendship and love that we have for each other is as strong now as it was back then. And so it's a very special place for me. I love Cornell and always fun to talk about it.
That's great. That's great. So what did you end up majoring in? Did you know what you were going to major in when you came? And did you play football the whole time you were here?
I did not play football the whole time.
Because that's a huge commitment.
I love my time on the team. There's still a lot of people that I'm still very close with that were on the team. Just some very close friends that are there, hoping the team will, you know, sort of elevate again. I think the last time that Cornell won the Ivies was when I was there, and we had a really good team there. And so I'm hopeful that the program can return. I studied agricultural economics. Okay. I think now it's Dyson and it's the business major, or it's applied economics or something like that. You know, I'm a proud ag ecky.
Nice. And did you know coming in that that's what you wanted to get into, or did you kind of discover that as you went through school?
So to be brutally honest, Kathy, I came with the plan to be an actuarial scientist. And So I studied statistics, and they moved the department from the ag quad to Riley Robb beyond the tennis bubbles. And just to show you how unmotivated I was academically at the time, I thought, that's too far for me to walk. So I'm going to change my major so I can stay in the ag quad. And I tell people that story today. I tell my kids that story, and you can imagine them shaking their head.
Right. Yeah, but you've done okay for yourself. So I think it's okay. So when you were at Cornell, you had no idea like, oh, well, I think I really want to have a company someday. I have this entrepreneurial bent. Like, that came later on. That wasn't something you did like right out of college, right?
Yeah, exactly right. So, you know, ignorance is probably bliss, right? And when I was graduating from college, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And this is something that I do spend a lot of time trying to help kids who right now are at school, and they worry like, should I be this major, and should I do this, that, or the other thing? It's sort of like, you know, let life develop a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. And take your time, take some pressure off yourself. And you don't need to be, you know, if you want to be number one in your class, be number one, knock yourself out. But you don't all have to go work for Goldman Sachs. Like, there's lots of paths to really enjoying whatever you do professionally. And frankly, also success is a measure that doesn't need to be measured in economic output, right? Like, success can be so many measures, right? And so, like, what's your personal fulfillment, and pursue things that you're interested in. And by the way, if you can kind of marry your personal passion with a work ethic and desire, there's no limit to what you can achieve. And so when I left, you know, growing up in a small town, my father gave me some career advice, and he said, go work for a big company. They're going to have good benefits. And, you know, which, you know, my father and my mother gave me so much in my life, and I'm so grateful for them. And that just was part of the way that I think they thought about the world in terms of how you think about your career. And so I did that. And I realized just through a lot of, I think, maturity and some self-discovery after college that, like, I think there's some common characteristics that a lot of entrepreneurs have. And, you know, you have to be able to think about the possible. You have to kind of be willing to bet on yourself. You have to be willing to work like a dog to make your vision become a reality. You have to bring other people along. And I think over the first handful of years working, I came to realize that there's a lot of things that I did in my youth that really did set me up to be an entrepreneur. And thankfully, my wife, Stephanie, who's a Cornell grad as well, she was always so encouraging. She was always so supportive of, go pursue it, give it a shot, go after it, right? And she supported us financially and allowed me to go try some of these things. And once I went into my first entrepreneurial gig, it was like being in heaven, right? I am someone who has ADD. Realized that later in life, but like, man, I can lose myself in my work for days on end, weeks on end. You know, when you're an entrepreneur and it requires you to invest the level of time to make your dream become a reality. In some ways, you have to be able to lose yourself into it to make it happen. And so it was only later in life that I came to realize that I'm an entrepreneur, and like, what gets me excited is doing the work I do today, but also helping other people and entrepreneurs help their, you know, dream become a reality.
Right. That's awesome. And your first entrepreneurial adventure was not Village MD. It was something else. So you've had some entrepreneurial adventures that weren't giant successes, and then you still kept along that path, which is, I think, a good lesson for someone who's thinking, well, if I try it once, it doesn't work, I should give up. Not true.
Yeah. And just to be clear, you're being polite when you say giant successes, because the first company I started was a failure. Like, by every, I mean, I learned so much during my time of launching this company and putting my whole soul into it. And literally every dollar I had saved up until that point in time in my life. I put in that company, lost it, lost money for my investors. Like, you name it. I don't, you could say we had success because we were identified as like a top 100 young company in Illinois, and we had some customers, and we had success by gaining customers, generating revenue, right? Like, any, for any entrepreneur, you know that if you do that, like, that is an element of success. But at the end of the day, you also have to be really honest and say, did I create a business that sustains? Then at the end of the day, if it doesn't, you have to be willing to also acknowledge that maybe that was a failure, and yet you learned so much along the way that it only makes you stronger and better the next time you do it.
And your wife stuck with you, even though she kept saying, just keep trying. There's got to be something, you know. That's awesome that you have a network of people who don't give up when you are probably thinking you should give up.
Yeah. I mean, she's the rock of my life. And so without doubt, support that she provided us at every time we started something has been absolutely amazing.
That's awesome. So I would love to know, to pass along some of your wisdom to some younger entrepreneurs or some people who are thinking about becoming an entrepreneur, what are some things that you've learned about the way you structure your day or the tools you use or habits you have that have really helped you to manage all the various balls that you might have in the air at the same time?
Yeah. So it's kind of funny because it's such a great question, Kathy. And I think that the way I'd answer it really depends on the stage of the company. And the first company I started, Evo Knowledge, it was a technology company. And I was so focused on the product, right? I put all the energy into, we've got to make sure this is so differentiated. And this is a N of one product. It's so unique. And wanted to make sure it was the absolute best thing we could. And part of it's just like a pride of like, I'm bringing something into the world. And I am a believer that, entrepreneurship is a creative endeavor. And so this is our art, right? And so you care so much about it. You want to make sure it's the best. And I think it's easy to over-index on the product and the solution and maybe building your business plan and spending your time on financial models and spreadsheets. And what you need to go out and do is you need to generate revenue. And so what I have found over the years is the absolute single biggest problem and failure of startups is that they don't spend more time selling. And selling is, there's lots of people in the world who I've come across in my career who are in jobs that require them to be in front of customers, and they think they're selling. And while they're quote unquote selling themselves, it's really relationship. There's a difference between having a relationship and getting someone to buy your product, to actually go through the process that involves legal, that involves finance, and ultimately a contract that says, I'm buying this from you. And so what I've found is that in the earliest stages, you've got to be focused on how do we make this cash register ring and really making sure that as much as you want to maybe spend time on, like, the product has to be good enough, obviously, otherwise you won't get a sale, but you really have to be spending your time there. So to me, so much of it in terms of how I would spend my time out of the gates is really making sure that we have the right revenue model, we have the right business model, that we know we can sell and get customers. And so that to me is sort of how I index pretty heavily. Over the years, especially as the company starts to grow and you start to bring in more of a team of people, what I have found is that you have to make sure you're investing the time in your team. You have to make sure that you're visible, that you are communicating, that even when you feel like you're communicating too much to your team and to your people, you're likely probably still not communicating, and that people want that time from you. They value that time from you, and you have to make the time and give them that time to make sure that they know that they feel supported by you. Whether you're a team of 5 or a team of 50, or in our case now, 20,000, you have to be investing in the people and setting the tone and the stage for what culture, what the company can be, and also to make sure that the culture of the organization is one that you hoped it would be when you started off when you were five people, and you have to keep investing in it all the time.
And as the leader of a team of 20,000 people, you obviously can't be in touch with 20,000 people. So the people you find to lead the teams of 20,000 people are the ones that you have, the senior people are the ones you invest in, and they need to be investing in this. So there is like this whole culture and this like ideas you have to pass down to them on what you, how you want them to lead their teams, which is, I would assume, a challenge.
What I find to be fun is, I mean, especially as you grow, is, you know, so much of it out of the early gate is you, the entrepreneur, you the founder or founders, and almost to the point where there's sometimes like a cult of personality, which on one level is good, on another level is bad, because you ultimately, for your company to succeed, you have to have a team of people who are there with you, right? And so over time, as you think about the mission, the vision, the values of the organization, that even if it was created by you, the entrepreneur, out of the gate, over time, it has to be a shared creation. And that's hard. It's really hard. And I tell you that there's a lot of days where I feel like I fail more than I succeed in regard to making sure we're bringing everyone together and closer together and a part of, you know, whatever we're trying to accomplish. Either we're opening up a new clinic every 73 hours, or we're having to make a painful decision to exit out of a market. Like, these are the kinds of things that I think you want to do together and know you're in this together, and that we're succeeding together, or we're, you know, we're falling together.
So you mentioned that you feel like when you were younger, there were some telltale signs or some things that make you think, oh, I was kind of almost destined to be an entrepreneur. Are there certain skills that you think you have, or that anyone who wants to be an entrepreneur might have, that make them kind of, that's the right path for them? What kinds of things do you think, like personality traits or skills or just way you are, make you that way?
I've thought a lot about this, and part of and I'm going to answer it maybe a little bit differently. What I have found is that when I was in college and I met these people who, you know, when they were in high school, they started a landscaping business and they mowed their neighbor's lawn. Then they started mowing the lawn of all of their neighbors and on the block. And then they started hiring people, and they were charging the customer, you know, $25 for the lawn mow, and they were paying someone $10. So they figured out how to create margin. And I would hear these stories of these people, and I was always like, wow, like, that's so impressive. It's so amazing. And I was like, that's not me. And so for so long, I felt like, well, gosh, I can't be an entrepreneur, because I just assumed that they had this trait, like they were born a certain way, or maybe they grew up in a family that's what they did. But I never really believed I could be an entrepreneur, because I didn't have that, right? And I was also, frankly, I had a high fear of failure. And so what was interesting about it is, like, after, it's only in retrospect that I look back and can say, yeah, there's things that I did that actually were helpful. And I like sharing that with people, because if there are those who think, well, gosh, I've never been an entrepreneur before, can I really be one? My answer to them is yes. Like, anyone can be. You just have to have, you know, enough conviction and enough commitment, and frankly, have the humility to know that you don't know everything. And that part of it is a learning journey, part of it is a creative journey, and part of it is a journey of bringing other people along. And so, like, I think back to being in Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin, and, you know, being involved in all kinds of sports and being a leader in those sports, or being, you know, the president of a math team or a science club or whatever it was. Like, there were a lot of things where I was placed into opportunities where I could lead and where I learned to either succeed or fail based upon those different opportunities. And so from that standpoint, I always thought that was really helpful. I also grew up with an orientation of having to sort of try to think critically about things. And I was always fascinated by mathematics. And so, you know, when it came to numbers, always came easy to me. And so as I thought about numbers, I always thought about just extrapolation of numbers. And so when you're in a business setting, and whether you're in a large company or a small company, your ability to really understand your numbers and how they apply and how you can imagine planning forward and imagine what's possible Like those are the kinds of things that I realize only in retrospect that are experiences I had as a kid that really helped shape, you know, who I am today.
But that's great advice that, you know, it's not necessarily there's these certain characteristics. And if you're not born with them, you can't be an entrepreneur. That, you know, that the more important thing is what it is and what you're passionate about and how dedicated you are to it. Yeah. So I always ask people if there's one thing that most people would be surprised to find out about you.
People are generally surprised when I tell them that I became certified to be a paraplane pilot. So I was in Dallas, Texas, working at EDS in between my first and second year of business school. And I have literally no idea why I decided to do this. I think it was someone I knew wanted to go give it a shot. And paraplane is, think of it like a go-kart that has a giant propeller on the back and then a parachute attached to that.
Okay, I was going to ask you what it was, and I'm assuming that everyone else other than me knew what it was. So good, you explained it. Okay.
So you start off and you're driving this go-kart, right, down a field, and you get enough speed that the parachute lifts and it pulls you up into the air. And you end up being 1,000 feet above the air and you're flying this thing around. And
so you're not going off the cliff, like off the edge of a cliff.
No, you're not. No.
But still, you're 1,000 feet up in the air.
You're 1,000 feet.
Holy cow.
And it's like only after the words do you think like, wow, all the things that may have gone wrong. And did I ask them to, like, you know, show me the certification that the propeller's been tightened and it's not going to fall off while I'm in the sky? All this sort of stuff. But yeah, I went through the experience, eventually got certified. I loved it. It was a really cool thing to do.
Wow. And do you still do that today? Or is that something you
don't I know? No, I do not do it today. And I think I'd be hard pressed to have the, you know, the confidence to do that today.
It sounds like it would be terrifying, but yeah. Exciting. Yeah. That's very cool.
The beauty of youth. Yeah.
So before we go, I have two things to ask you. If you have a book you would recommend and or a business or other person who you admire that you would want to share with us.
Yeah. So I just finished the book, How to Know a Person by David Brooks. And I found it fascinating. I thought it was a great read. It's a quick read. You're not going to want to put it down. And so much of it is, you know, I think in life, we come to know people a little bit, but we don't necessarily always, you know, see them in their entirety. And the book is really, really spectacular. It kind of just breaks down the different types of people and sort of the barriers that they might have, and as well as the positive attributes that they might have. And it's an inspiring book, frankly. And I found it really helpful in the context of just personal relationships, but also from the standpoint of how I do my work, frankly. And are you really investing the time to get to know people? You know, it's funny, over the years, when I interview someone, my favorite question to ask people now, my new favorite question is to sit down with them and say, how did you become you? Just to leave it open and let them tell you their story. Instead of saying, well, tell me how you, like, why'd you go to Goldman Sachs when you were 24? Right. You hear these incredible things, and I find it so fascinating. So that's the book recommendation. Person I most admire is, to be honest, my wife. She's an incredible woman. She's brilliant. She's caring. She's loving. What she does in the span of a day, I am always like, man, I think I work hard, but like she accomplishes so yeah. much more. And at the end of the day, she invested in our family in a way that allowed me to sort of have this crazy life as an entrepreneur. And her keeping our family as strong as she has is I admire her every day.
And one of your kids is a freshman at Cornell.
Yeah. McCoy is a freshman right now, having a great time. It's fun for Stephanie and me as Cornell grads to go back and to see him, you know, experience it through his own eyes, but every now and again, experience some of the things that we did, and for him to maybe have a heightened experience because he gets to see it through our eyes as well.
Thank you so much for joining us, Tim.
Yeah, thrilled to have done it. Thanks so much, Kathy. It's great discussion.
Great. So to find out more about entrepreneurship at Cornell and see the show notes from this episode, visit eshop.cornell.edu. And a special thanks to Abigail Younger, my editor extraordinaire.